Good morning and welcome to another edition of Hawaii Matters. I'm Michael T. in for Diane Ako. Here in Hawaii, it's obvious we're surrounded by the Pacific Ocean, and one of the activities that many people engage in is fishing. Joining us today are two guests from the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council. They're here to talk about fishing in Hawaii and specifically the Fisherman Code of Conduct. Joining us are Sylvia Spaulding, she's the Media and Education Specialist for the Council, and Charles Ka'ai'ai, the Indigenous Program Coordinator for the Fishery Council. Welcome, both of you.
Oh, thank you. Good morning.
Charles, we'll start with you. What is the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council? That's a long name.
Yeah, well, the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council is one of eight regional fishery management councils established by Congress, the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act in 1976. The Western Pacific Council has authority over the fisheries in the Pacific Ocean seaward of state and territorial waters around Hawaii, American Samoa, Guam, and the Northern Mariana Islands. During the first 35 years, the Council's accomplishments have run the gamut from being the first regional fishery management council in the nation to prohibit drift gillnet fishing and develop an ecosystem-based fishery management plan, and being the pioneer of vessel monitoring system for fishing vessels, which is now being implemented in fisheries worldwide. The Council is made up of 16 Council members, the Council staff, and hundreds of people in the Council's numerous advisory bodies. So we have a lot of people in our Council family. The Council process is a bottom-up process, so we depend on our advisors to let us know what's happening in the fisheries, what's happening in their communities with regard to fisheries, and try to stay on top of the situations that are developing. And the Council's mission is to promote sustainable fishing. So we're all for fishing for our communities.
That's good. So, Charles, when you say the Council has authority over the fisheries, what kind of authority is that? What's the magnitude of the authority? And then who comes under that authority? Is it like the average Joe fisherman? Or is it the industry, the fishing industry? Or is it everybody in between?
Well, you're talking about the federal jurisdiction. And the federal jurisdiction, the Council has authority over fisheries from the territorial and state waters seaward. So we're talking about the federal fisheries. These are the longline fisheries. We have some crustacean fisheries. We have other fisheries that we manage. So we create the rules and regulations that govern those fisheries and try to make those rules that will be sustainable and will keep people in the fisheries, keep people fishing.
When you say seaward, what does that mean?
Seaward, it means away from the shore. Like we, for example, Hawaii. There's a 3-mile state waters, which state has jurisdiction over. Mm-hmm. And then from 3 to 200 is the U.S. economic zone. Yeah. And then the federal fishers go from 3 miles to seaward, to beyond, even beyond the 200-mile zone.
Got it. So inside of that 3-mile, it's all
state jurisdiction. Okay. Right.
And you guys are concerned with outside of that.
Right.
Just so we know who we're talking about, and you know, if the average person listening right now is like, does this apply to me? It might not apply, but it's important for
right.
people to know.
Right.
It's important for people to know because, you know, when they get their sashimi and their local bottom fish, it's from these fisheries.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about the council a little bit. How does one become a fishery council member?
Okay, for the state of Hawaii and for the territories, people are recommended. They ask for about 3 people for every position. They're recommended by the governor of the state or territory. Mm-hmm. And that goes before the Secretary of Commerce. And the Secretary of Commerce makes a decision on who should sit on the council. And the whole idea is to have a balance on the council of industry people, government people, the regular non-commercial fisheries, recreational people, to have a nice mix on the council so that a good, appropriate decisions can be made on creating rules and regulations.
Hmm. So when the council makes decisions, like how many people are affected? Like in the fishing industry, how many people are in for this Western region, how many people are you guys talking about? Your jurisdiction extends out to how many people?
Well, a lot of the decisions the council makes will impact almost everyone in the state, everyone in that community. What we're really talking about, if we're talking about the longliners, are about 170 longline permits that are available that have been permitted, people that can fish, 170 fishers. We make a regulation that affect them, but they bring in the fish that hit our market, and the fish, the quality, the amount that hit our market determines the prices that all of us pay for those fishes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So we know a little bit about the council, we're touching on the whole fishing industry. What are the big issues that are facing the industry relative to the Western Region Fishing Council?
There's a number of issues. All of them are kind of timely. For our longline fisheries, they're really managed internationally. In other words, they're managed by agreements we make with international organizations, other people that use the high seas for fishing. Some of the other issues that we face are interactions with protected species, endangered species, sea turtles, whales, migratory birds. There are also market forces at work on the fisheries. So there's a whole bunch of issues that the council will have to deal with in making decisions on rules and regulations, on conduct of fishing, and looking at what kind of research we need to support the decisions that we've made.
Mm-hmm.
So on the long line fishery, as Charlie said, besides being managed by the council as far as how many permits, boat size, regulations like that, where we come up with a fishery ecosystem plan, and they have management measures in there, and then they're forwarded to the Secretary of Commerce, which approves them. But beyond that, as Charlie was saying, the United States is a member of certain treaties in the Western and Central Pacific Ocean, and also in the Eastern Pacific Ocean. And that's because tuna and other, like billfish, are highly migratory. And so just to have one nation regulate it, won't really take care of the stock. And so one of the issues we have right now is for the big eye tuna, which is where our sashimi comes from.
Mm-hmm.
There's also purse seine fishery that catches skipjack tuna, which is the smaller tuna for the canned tuna industry. Mm-hmm. But in the last couple of decades, they started setting fish aggregation devices that have caught not only the skipjack, but juvenile big eye and yellowfin tuna. So there is an issue of overfishing a big eye right now.
Mm.
And because of that, they've set international quotas by nations for the longline fishery, and then vessel days around FADs for the purse seine fishery. So because of that, our Hawaii longline fishery for big eye tuna is being restricted in fishing for big eye from now until the rest of the year because of the quota.
How does that impact the average person?
One, for local big eye, there probably will be less of it, and maybe prices will rise.
Mm-hmm.
And also, then what you do is you get imports in. And for, like, sashimi, they're usually carbon monoxide to keep the color in them.
Mm.
And then they're frozen. And so there's more of a risk, depending on how they're handled in these foreign countries, of getting salmonella and other, health issues introduced. So also, it's just a matter of preference, too. Do you want fresh fish? Because all of the tuna landed in Hawaii is fresh, just iced or frozen.
Two things strike me while you were answering. The breadth of subject matter, it seems really wide for the council. And the things that you do and you come in contact with, decisions that you guys make, really do affect people listening to this program.
Right, it does, yeah. Because, if we begin to import, if we have to close the fishery and we begin to import fish from elsewhere, that undercuts our fishing industry, because now they have another source, and will our fishing industry be able to fill that in another year or in another season?
Yeah, and then by industry, too, it's not just the fishermen, right?
Yeah.
It's tackle shops, ice shops, the retailers, wholesalers.
There's a whole domino effect of activity. You're listening to Hawaii Matters. It's Michael T. in for Diana Ko this morning. We're talking to Sylvia Spaulding, the Media and Education Specialist for the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, and Charles Ka'ai'ai, the Indigenous Program Coordinator for the Fishery Council. Specifically, you guys are here to talk about the code of conduct that governs, I don't know if that's the right word, fishing industry. Can you tell us, Charles, what is the code of conduct?
Well, a code of conduct is a non-regulatory set of rules that supports the regulatory regime. A community code of conduct is a code of conduct that a community develops to guide their behavior towards certain resources. For communities, it can be very specific or it can be very general, but supports the regulatory regime. And so what that is kind of like an unwritten law, right? You have an unwritten law that supports the way the fishery is managed or the way people behave. And so that the importance of that community code of conduct is that it encourages voluntary compliance. The community conduct is developed in the community and they vet it through their community, and compliance with the codes will be good, right? Because everybody's agreed that this is a good set of rules that we can follow that will support this regulatory regime. And the community enforces that code through community and peer pressure. But it's another tool that we use in managing the fishery and natural resources. For the industry code of conduct, they have to develop their own. We have a kind of a generic code of conduct to deal with fisheries. We feel that everybody should be using this code of conduct to stay within the regulations that we ask, and to be kind of, you know, when we did the when we had a conference and one of the kupuna said, oh, that's just common sense, it's just what we do. I mean, that's kind of a code of conduct, right? Mm-hmm. It's that code of conduct for that community. So having a code of conduct just supports the regulatory regime. I think it makes the fisheries better.
So the challenge, as I hear it, would be communicating that code of conduct. How does the communication of those of the code of conduct happen?
Well, for us, it would be education and outreach. In the community, it would be the community passing it on by word of mouth, or creating a kind of a regime where people are automatically doing this. You know, we don't normally do this here. We don't do that kind of stuff here. That kind of stuff, right? But for this kind of general code of conduct, we really want to get out there with education and outreach and have everyone agree to it, buy into it, see that it makes a lot of sense. And in that way, create a regular system of good behavior in fisheries and in natural resources. Yeah.
So I guess that begs the question, is there resistance at all at any time to, like, when you say, this is the way we do that, what if somebody says, well, I'd rather do it not that way?
Right, right. There's always that. There's always that issue that's going to arise, right, that I don't agree with your code of conduct. And that's why it's important that when you develop a code of conduct, you develop it with the community that you want that code of conduct to exist in. You know, and then you have this voluntary compliance. And again, like laws and like regulations, you're not going to have 100% compliance. But if you can get voluntary compliance, that makes enforcing regulations so much easier.
So I guess you're saying it works. Peer pressure works in this situation.
Yes.
And
oh, yes.
Would you say that the compliance, if you had to grade compliance in the fishing industry, could you give it a number? Like we have 100% compliance, we have 50%. What would be the number?
I don't know what a number would be, but I would say that we have a really good compliance in our fishery in Hawaii.
That's good.
With the regulations. I mean, really, really good compliance. And yeah, there may be complaints and they show up at the council meeting, right, to register their complaints. But once it's decided, our industry is professional enough that they will comply.
The Fisherman Code of Conduct that we're going to be talking about a lot today is one that's more for the nearshore fisheries, or, you know, fisheries that community members use. There is another code of conduct by the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. It's a code of conduct for responsible fisheries. And for our longline fishery, it's been assessed by a third party, and they're like 90 to 95% compliant which is the highest compliance in the world.
Wow, that's a high batting average.
Yeah,
that's good. Charles, tell us about the going back to the local code of conduct. It's part of a larger system. Can you tell us about that, a locally based system?
Yeah, well, code of conduct was when we did Puvalu series of conferences and talked to Native Hawaiians in Hawaii, and they came up with this idea of ahamoku management. One of the things that we had to do and we worked with the community with was finding out what this traditional resource management system looks like. And there were actually five pillars that the code of conduct was part of. And the Ahakiole Advisory Committee with reported back to the legislature on these five pillars of traditional resource management. That committee was temporary, and a later legislative act created the Ahamoku Advisory Committee within DLNR. And the Ahamoku promotes traditional values for all of Hawaii, residents and visitors alike. So the code of conduct was part of that package. There were five pillars in that package.
Mm-hmm. So we are talking about something that is attentive to the traditions of Hawaii and how we've done things over the decades, maybe centuries?
Decades.
Yeah, decades.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit more about the five pillars of the Ahamoku.
Okay, well, the legislature had tasked the Ahakiole Advisory Committee with coming up with the system of best practices for traditional management. The idea was that Hawaiians lived here for over 1,000 years and they were able to manage their resources, so they must have had a way to manage their resource. Mm-hmm. So when the Ahakiole Advisory Committee went out to the community, what they found out that was that there were five pillars to this traditional management, and that was an adaptive management system. So it's a regulatory system where you create regulations that respond to the environmental and other impacts that you have, right? So if there's a if, say, moi is down, right? You go in the water and see there's not much moi. Mm. You put kapu on moi so that the moi can come back, right?
Okay.
So you have this adaptive system of creating regulations. And then when they do come back, you have a way to say, okay, now moi is okay. Everybody can fish for that. Well, then something else may be in low abundance, yeah, mm-hmm. a holy something. Then you create a kapu for that. So it's this kind of adaptive, always monitoring the ecosystem and always developing regulations that support that ecosystem. The second pillar was the code of conduct. And it was a way that people would learn to habitually behave in that system, right? Mm-hmm. So that the bad behavior was not allowed in that system. Mm. So that was the code of conduct. This is the way we do things. This is how we harvest this. This is how we, this is the net we use for this. This is the kind of hook we use for this. Then the third one was community consultations, because apparently in the old days, the Konohiki had to consult with his community, had to find out what was important to the community, what the community valued, how they wanted the resource to be managed. You know, if somebody is hungry for manini today, is the manini a good thing to catch today? You go and get the advice of the Konohiki. Education, and that education was so that everybody knew what was happening, how the regulations were made, what the codes of conduct were, what the state of the resource was. And then the last thing they came up was eligibility criteria to participate in the management process. And they said, well, if you want to participate in the management process and make recommendations and try and push rules and stuff, then you need to know something about the resource. Mm-hmm. So the best guy, I guess the best example you can think of that is that, you know, if you want to make rules about Akule, you could talk to the Akule guy,
mm-hmm.
right? And he would know how the Akule is and what rules should be put in place.
Mm.
So that was the five pillars: the adaptive management, the code of conduct, community consultation, education, and eligibility criteria to participate in the process.
It sounds like a lot of common sense applied to the whole fishing industry. You're listening to Hawaii Matters. It's Michael T in for Diana Ko this morning. We're talking to Sylvia Spaulding, the Media and Education Specialist for the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, and Charles Ka'ai'ai, the Indigenous Program Coordinator for the Fishery Council. Sylvia, what are the codes? Tell us about the codes in this Code of Conduct.
Okay, so there's nine of them. One is respect nature and your place in it. Two, seek advice of experts with generational knowledge of the local resources. Three, show regard to spawning seasons and juvenile fish. Four, do not waste, take only what is needed. Five, keep safe people, property, and resources. Six, obey fishing laws and rules. Seven, use proper gear and techniques. Eight, pick up your trash. And nine, share your catch.
Again, very basic, very commonsensical. Right. And right. I like that about that. So how was the code developed?
Well, Charlie alluded to some conferences that we held where we brought in Native Hawaiian practitioners from all of the islands. That was in 2006 and 2007. And then we, and they had mentioned, you know, the Code of Conduct came out with the Aha Kaikiole report. So we went back and looked at the minutes, you know, or not the minutes, but just the records of those conferences, and looked at some of the advice that the elders were giving during the conference. And so then we pulled out these that were said frequently mm-hmm. by various elders, these 9 points. And then so we came up with them. We looked at a lot of other codes that are out there, you know, for spearfishing, and the state of Hawaii has put out codes, and other people have put out codes. And we wanted to keep ours simple. It's not like some fishing groups have a commitment code. We didn't want ours to be a commitment thing that people had to sign. It's just something educational, you know, to go out there. And so we held a fishers forum after that because we did want it run by the community. So in 2011, we had it down at the Waikiki Aquarium with hundreds of people. We brought in different speakers. We showed various different codes that are in existence, including that United Nations code that I talked about earlier, which is very lengthy. And then we just got their feedback on it. And also got feedback from a lot of the agencies and fishing groups and various people, and everyone seemed to be happy with these 9 points.
So curious question, what did we do before these practices and codes went into place, like decades before? Were there any issues, and how did people govern themselves?
I think that there were always codes of conduct in place. We may not have written them down or even paid attention to them. It's just a common way that you would behave, you know, at that time, in the context of the time, in the context of the regulations that were created, that common way that you would behave there. And, you know, a code of conduct is really a voluntary compliance, yeah? You see the code of conduct, wow, if it makes sense to you, then we ask you to comply with it. If you take issue with them, then we can discuss that issue, yeah?
What are the challenges of having everybody adapt and accept this code of conduct?
Well, one of the issues is for people who live in Hawaii and are raised in Hawaii and were born here, they assimilate the code, you know, they as they're growing up. But for newcomers who come, like new immigrant groups that have come into Hawaii, or maybe even the military who come in, they might not know, you know, how we behave in Hawaii, you know. And so those are some of the issues with trying to get the code more well-known, and why we are translated in various languages.
Okay. In general, how long does it take to, I don't know if you have if you could put your finger on this, how long does it take for a new coming immigrant group to assimilate themselves with regard to the fishing industry? Can you put a finger on that?
You know, that's a really hard question. I think that when we have other Pacific Islanders come to Hawaii, they come from another culture that has its own code of conduct, has its own regulations. Mm. And they come here and maybe they have the idea that, whoa, there are no rules here. Mm. you know, and begin to conduct themselves without those community pressures on them to conduct themselves in a certain way. And it's kind of a good shield for them too, right? I didn't know. And I think that in my experience is if you just talk to them and say, you know, this is how we do it here. And in one community I saw on the Big Island where the community was complaining about the way certain Micronesian groups were fishing, when a person of that Micronesian group came to them to a community meeting and explained himself, they welcomed him in and said, okay, this is how we do it here. You know, and then why don't you come down Sunday? We're going to have a gathering. And so I think there's an opportunity for cross-cultural kind of relations to occur. And then there's also that need, right, to have that code of conduct so that they know that they can go someplace, they can get a code of conduct in their language, they can learn a little bit about this new place that they've moved to and maybe become a better citizen here. Yeah.
Nice. So that leads into the question, how does anybody learn about the codes? How are they displayed? What's the outreach look like, Sylvia?
Okay, so, well, we have had, and there are signs down on some harbors in Molokai on Oahu that we've put up with the Department of Land and Natural Resources Division of Boating and Ocean Recreation. They partnered with us on that, as well as some of the local ahamokus who have agreed to help make sure the signs are maintained. The lifeguards have expressed an interest in them, and so we might have signs near their stations. And then also we've had the fishing and boating clubs express an interest, Hawaiian civic clubs. I went to some neighborhood boards and talked about this, and the canoe clubs. A lot of people have really expressed an interest in them. So we have signs in harbors. We have posters that are both waterproof and not waterproof. We've distributed them to Hawaiian charter and immersion schools. We also have public service announcements that have been playing on TV stations, and we're going to be playing them on more radio and TV stations here coming up because we've now translated them in other languages, as I mentioned. So they can also go to our council website at wpcouncil.org and download anything. We're going to be making some postcards that we're putting in some conference bags for various conferences that will be held. So, teachers, fishing clubs, or anybody is interested in getting copies, they could go to our website or call us or email us.
Yeah, that's www.wpcouncil.org.
This is a radio station, and we know that communication costs money. Where does the funding for all this? I bet you're challenged with not enough funds to get the word out. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, I have a certain amount of budget for outreach each year, and some of that had, when we began this, actually we began this campaign back in 2010, we had a grant with the Coral Reef program with NOAA that we used. We're using some other grant funds that we have on sustainable fisheries. But we feel like this is important, and so we are doing it. Mm-hmm. Also, the public service announcements, we're trying to get, you know, stations to play that for free. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so.
It's always a challenge, though.
Yes, it is. Getting
the word out. We know that. So what other campaigns or projects is the Fishery Council working on?
Well, we have a quarterly newsletter, so people can subscribe to receive that by electronic files, or they can get hard copies if they go to our website and sign up for it. We're also looking at putting a video out for grade school students on how our fish are caught and end up on your plate, because it seems like a lot of people who are used to buying food at the stores don't understand the whole process of where your fish comes from and where it goes through to get onto your plate. We've been supporting traditional lunar calendars since 2007, and we're supporting a lunar conference that's coming up here at the University of Hawaii this year. We're helping communities establish fishery management plans. We're looking at the minimum size of ahi that's being caught around Hawaii. And also we're updating our fishery ecosystem plans and annual reports to include more of the ecosystem-based management rather than just species-based management.
How can people get involved and learn more, and what more is there to learn?
Yeah, so again, if they can go to our website, and from there they can subscribe to our Facebook or Twitter account. We also have a YouTube and a Vimeo channels. We have council meetings three times a year and a fishers forum that goes along with that in the evening time.
Mm-hmm. Where do you meet?
Well, we've been meeting at Pier 38, but we've met in other places. We've met down at Waikiki Aquarium, I mean, for the fishers forum I'm talking about, mm-hmm. or right down here at the end of the street here.
Lanikea?
Yeah, at Lanikea YWCA is where we've held our council meetings there recently. Ala Moana Hotel, we've held them. But we make a lot of announcements on it. If they subscribe to our newsletter or to any of our Facebook or Twitter accounts, they'll get notices of that. Right. But and we also mail them notices. We also run things on Hawaii Goes Fishing, Let's Go Fishing. We help support radio stations that cover fishing talk shows. So there's a lot of ways, yeah. And we really want people to get involved because it's a bottom-up process. Yeah. We want their advice on how their fishery should be managed sustainably so that they can have fresh fish forever.
And if you visit our website, you can always get our calendar of meetings that are going on.
There you go. Yeah. All right. Cool. And the website, one more time?
Is www.wpcouncil.org.
Thank you. We've been talking to Sylvia Spaulding, the Media and Education Specialist for the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, and Charles Ka'ai'ai, the Indigenous Program Coordinator for the Fishery Council. This is Hawaii Matters. Thanks for listening.